Work done with Alberto Nicholas, who is here, and Christoph at Harvard. I realize a non-trivial fraction of the audience here have actually heard some version of this talk. So what I will try to do is to tell you kind of the newer results first, and then tell you some of the older ones. And the new result kind of give an interesting overall perspective too, so kind of fits into a nice overall framework. The subject is equivalence principle, in particular, basically, equivalence principle in the context of a scalar tensor theory. And what I want to discuss is both the fact that actually it's fairly robust and somewhat in contradiction that you could also find violations of it. And I'll talk about both classical and quantum aspects of the problem. So I think most of this slide, the ideas were covered in Alberto's talk, so I won't belabor the point. It's just that, let me just reiterate that scalar tensor theory seems to be actually fairly ubiquitous in current ideas about how to modify gravity on long distance scales. If you take the appropriate limits, they all reduce to some form of scalar tensor theory, even for theories that are like five-dimensional, like DGP. If you take the sub-horizon limit, it reduces to some form of scalar tensor theory, as discussed in Alberto's talk. So I'll take as my starting point something like this. So I'll just start here, where in this talk, this phi is that scalar that mediates a fifth force, if you like. And this is written in Einstein frame. The scalar have some non-trivial self-interactions. Much of the interesting physics will come from here. We'll talk about what are the self-interactions that we need. And crucially, this scalar is coupled to matter and is coupled to the trace of the matter communion. And in this talk, I'll use the alpha to denote basically that coupling. When alpha in the way in my normalization, when alpha is order one, I basically mean the scalar that is coupled to matter at gravitational strength. And of course, the dot, dot, dot here represent the usual stuff, the Einsteinian part of the action, the matter action, and so forth. But I just want to single out the part that tells you how the matter couples to the metric perturbation, is coupled in this way, kind of analogous to how the scalar couples to matter. And the way this is written is that the scalar explicitly is universally coupled. Universally coupled meaning that is coupled to all forms of matter actually with the same strength, which is not something that you have to do. It's not mandatory. Whereas for gravity, for graviton, it's mandatory. Whereas for scalar, you could couple to actually any of the scalars you want. The trace of T minu is not the only scalar around. So what I want to first discuss is if you write down something like this, why is this robust? Why is the universal scaling robust? And under what conditions you would actually violate, leading to interesting observational signatures. So here's the plan of my talk. The first part I want to discuss is basically to ask the question, is a universally coupled scalar stable against classical and quantum corrections? And I'll tell you the answer at the very beginning, that the answer would turn out to be a partial yes. Partial meaning if you only focus on corrections in the matter sector. I'll explain that more later. But this is some form of scalar equivalence principle, i.e. if you start with a theory where the scalar is universally coupled, it's actually a relatively robust theory. It doesn't, that the universal nature of it actually doesn't get violated. However, the derivation will also make clear there are two caveats. And the two caveats are, one of them is actually fairly well known, has been known for a long time. The first caveat is that the equivalence principle can actually be violated if the graviton self-interactions are important, for example, for black hole. And that effect actually is not known. It has been known for a long time, sometimes called the not that effect. Discuss that. Actually, the bulk of the talk is actually on the third point, the second caveat, which would also be made clear once we go through how the first point come about, is that you can also violate equivalence principle if the scalar self-interactions are important. For example, in chameleon theory, or in a more recent version of it, it's called Symmetron by Hinderbickler and Curry. Unless that the self-interactions respect certain symmetry, for example, Galilean symmetry, like Albert talked about yesterday. And then I'll talk about observational consequences, how we could look for these effects. And I want to emphasize the effects that I have in mind, they are not small. They are order one effects, meaning if you drop two objects in the same external field, meaning the same external gravitational and scalar field, they would actually fall at a rate that's order one different in certain situations, which I'll discuss. And then I'll have some random comments to make that kind of address some of the questions or issues that were raised in the earlier talks. Okay, so let's go back to this theory that I wrote down, a universally coupled scalar, just to remind you, this is that theory. And we are interested in how an object, which is basically denoted by this sphere here, some object, in the presence of some external long wavelength field, and that field includes both the gravitational field and the scalar field. I'll focus on the scalar. And by taking this limit, I'm explicitly ignoring basically tides. What do I mean by that? To give you a more familiar example, if you look at the motion of the Earth in the presence of the Sun, clearly the tidal field of the Sun doesn't really affect the motion of the Earth. You basically can treat the Earth almost as if it's a point object. That is because the length scale on which the Sun's gravitational field vary is much longer than the size of the Earth. So I'm taking that kind of limit. So no tidal effects. And in that limit, really, the interaction term that is of interest, which is basically this term, you can rewrite that as basically some kind of scalar charge, which I call Q, times basically the well line action of the object. No? You are integrating basically phi along the well line of this object. The scalar field is very long wavelength. And the scalar charge would be basically a volume integral of the trace of mu. And for the moment, let me ignore the gravitational and scalar self-interactions, which is, of course, where the interesting violations will come from. But ignoring that for now, let me show you why actually the equivalence principle is fairly robust, even for scalar. And the reason actually is kind of like a three lines, actually. Reasoning, let me step through it. The scalar charge, Q, which I defined there, let me split it into the time-time part and the space-space part. The time-time part is, of course, just give you the density, the mass density of the object, if you do the integral of it, you get the mass, m. This part, you can rewrite in this form. And the idea is when you take derivative respect to x, you basically get back this term. When you take derivative respect to t mu nil or tij, you will get zero upon assuming two things. One, that t mu nil is conserved, and two, you ignore time derivatives, i.e. you have a system which is basically in a stationary state. If that is true, that this term can be written as a total derivative. When you take this surface, this volume integral should, of course, be integral over all space, and therefore, outside the object is just zero, and you just get m. So what you have is basically the scalar charge, which you could think of as the kind of the scalar gravitational mass, if you want, is guaranteed to be equal to the inertial mass, which is m. Inertial mass is just the volume integral of the matter t00. So this is a kind of a equivalence principle, and let me put it together, the scalar with the graviton together in a kind of a Newtonian kind of equation of motion. If I look at an object and I want to ask what is the force on that object, well, the inertial mass times the acceleration of the object would be have two pieces in the Einstein frame. That's the usual piece due to the graviton, basically the mass times gradient of the gravitational potential, and the scalar part. The m here really should be the scalar charge, but as we show here, the scalar charge is just equal to m. So I can basically put m here. The same m appear in all three places as usual. You can cancel them out of the equation, which means for any object, regardless of its mass, whether it's small or large, regardless of its internal structure even, they would just fall at the same rate. In the presence of this external gravitational field and scalar field. So it's some kind of equivalence principle. And again, the reason is robust, if you put in there at the beginning, is because of basically conservation of community, the method. And yes?
Of mass.
Yes, it's an isolated, you think of it as an isolated object. That object could be a proton.
It has to do with the internal motion of this.
Yeah, the internal motion is fine. So, yeah, it can have internal motion going around. But if you think of gravitational system, it could be a very light system, for example. So it's not saying you have perfectly static situation inside. Yes. And the same argument can be extended quantum mechanically. Basically, you just run exactly the same argument as I thought about in the last slide, the charge. You just sandwich basically this volume integral of T mu nu, or the trace of T, between some state. And the state could, for example, describe protons, a proton, where that state is some complicated object that involves, you know, the gluons and the quarks and so on. And
you calculate this, basically run the same argument, you discover the charge, scalar charge, is actually equal to the m of the mass of the object. And this is true even quantum mechanically. And this very kind of a little bit, maybe a little bit too slick of a proof, you can actually kind of gain some insight into why certain very non-trivial cancellations actually occur if you do an explicit check. So you can actually check, if you write down a theory, which I'll describe in a second, whether the universal scalar coupling is stable against quantum corrections. And in fact, there was an earlier check by Fuji, I think it was in 96, that checked if you have a scalar tensor theory that is coupled to QED, is the universal nature of the scalar coupling respected by quantum correction? And he showed that it is. And it requires some very non-trivial cancellations, which now, with this proof, it makes it clear why actually that happens. So let me give you a simpler example, which is this one. Suppose you have two kinds of particles in the universe, and these are just scalar particles. So I call particle A, particle B. You have the usual kinetic term, mass term, kinetic mass term. It's the interaction, some kind of quantic interactions between the A and B particles and among themselves. And so this is the action for them. And then you couple basically the trace of P mu nu for them to the scalar with some coupling alpha. Again, in this talk, alpha is something like order one quantity. Now you can run the arguments and ask, you know, how does the mass, this term, get renormalized? And you'll be basically calculating diagrams like this because of this quantum coupling, where these loops involve loops in B and also in A. Yeah, so that renormalizes this mass. But you can also ask, well, how does this term get renormalized? And it actually comes from these two diagrams. This is, again, basically a loop running around in B or A. And likewise there. And the amazing thing is if you actually work it out explicitly, what you find is that the renormalized mass here and the renormalized mass there, they are exactly the same. They get renormalized in exactly the same way. Maybe what is helpful is to actually say the reverse. Suppose you find they don't get renormalized in the same way. Suppose you find a mass that is renormalized in one way, but then here, this term get renormalized in some other way. What does that mean? That means basically your phi is no longer coupled to the trace of T mu nu of that theory. Instead, it's coupled to that trace of T mu nu times some additional factor that might be species dependent, depending on whether you're talking about A or B, depending on, you know, because this coupling can be arbitrary, it's basically arbitrary. Yes.
You just have one metric and you don't have as long as phi is classical, then this is like an obvious statement in the Jordan effect, because you just have one metric and you don't have anything else to couple to.
No, but he has a coupling between the scalar charge.
But that's in the Jordan frame, you don't, because as long as you ignore gravitational quantum gravity, basically, then you just have a metric in the Jordan frame which couples to matter.
Yes.
And then since you just have one metric, only everything should couple to that. You don't have anything else.
Well, what you're saying is kind of like an assumption. Is that true? In other words, once you consider quantum corrections, so you still have a Jordan frame, basically.
But you're just doing quantum matter, not quantum gravity. So as long as you're not quantizing phi, then yes, you do have the Jordan frame, because metric is classical.
No, you have to actually explicitly check whether you start with the assumption that your theory has a Jordan frame. What you want to ask is, once you consider quantum corrections, in other words, for example, in the Jordan frame, what is non-trivial is the coupling between phi and the graviton. Once you consider that, the question is whether the fact that you have a Jordan frame, which is an assumption from the beginning.
But your phi and graviton are classical here, so you're just quantizing matter. So the argument for Jordan to Einstein.
Yeah, I think the confusion is that the Jordan frame metric contains a scalar from an Einstein frame point of view. So when I say I'm considering basically the scalar interactions, you have to keep that in mind, no?
Well, as long as it's classical, it doesn't matter, it's just external leg. You have external legs for G mu nu. It doesn't matter what's inside G mu nu, because it's classical, it's just a number.
For instance, if I can make a comment, you know that in Jordan frame, matter, even in GR, forget about for a second about scalar tensor theory, matter loops are going to renormalize the kinetic energy of the graviton, like G newton.
That's right. Yeah.
So what Nam is saying is that now in Jordan frame, the kinetic energy, the kinetic Lagrangian for the graviton is modified by a scalar prefactor, and you have to make sure that the renormalization of the G mu nu in front is going to affect both R and R times phi in precisely the same way. And that's not obvious a priori.
But that's the thing, as long as you're just doing classical gravity,
yes,
then it doesn't matter what you do to the kinetic term of graviton.
Because it matters in the sense that that's precisely, as Lam is saying, a statement about the effective coupling of the scalar to matter once you go to Einstein frame. Right, so this here, in a sense, what Lam is showing is that alpha in front doesn't even get renormalized. Now you're just renormalizing for instance, the inertial mass of the particles, okay? But the coupling to the scalar is totally unaffected, and in particular, it remains species independent. And that's a non-trivial statement.
I think it's as long as you don't quantize phi and graviton, I think it's a trivial statement, but we can discuss that.
In the standard Jordan Bernstein theory, in the Jordan frame, the scalar field only couples to curvature, and this guarantees you get a geodesic equation.
Yes.
Test particle. So you're clean on the equivalence principle. So only when you go to conformal transformation in the Einstein frame, because you get the coupling with the tracing.
Yeah, okay, very good. So I think there is a physically invariant statement, which is,
let me just do an experiment. I'm going to drop two objects. Do they fall the same way or not? And that doesn't matter whether you think of it in Jordan frame or Einstein frame. If they don't fall the same way, it really actually does tell you that your objects it cannot be true that both of them move on Jordan frame geodesics. And the statement that you make, as I'll discuss later, it applies to test particles, but it doesn't apply to, in some sense, macroscopic objects, more complicated objects.
Mm-hmm. The physics is much more complicated because the test point is not in reality.
Not in Einstein,
no.
Correct.
But the theory is different from what is invariant.
Yes.
And it's not conformally invariant. Zero is not. So you can't get a different result in the Einstein frame compared to the Jordan frame. In the standard shape. You wouldn't expect a violation of the protocols.
Yeah, that's the surprising thing. That's what I want to go over. Let me go over my argument, and then we can talk about again why this surprising is pointed out. Okay, so at the level of basically quantum corrections in the matter sector, the scalar equivalence principle appears to be actually fairly robust. And again, the reason is because of conservation of the matter kingdom. And I don't think the check is actually trivial in Jordan frame, but let's talk about that afterwards. Yes, this is Einstein frame. I'm basically in this talk. I'm largely mostly in Einstein. But this is Einstein frame in the sense that the scalar field is explicitly coupled to the matter, whereas in Jordan frame you don't have. Oh, this is just the matter part of the action, right? The matter particles have their own action. Yes? So the matter particles have their own action, and then you, if you want to think of this in, let's say this matter action, and let's say my phi, I'm doing basically perturbation theory, but in general, let's say I have some e to the alpha phi, let's say, and it's coupled to the Einstein frame metric. And let's say there's some matter field, which is what I call psi A and E here. And this is the Einstein frame, this is the Einstein frame metric, this is the Jordan frame metric. So the matter is minimally coupled to the Jordan frame metric. Now if you expand it out, this part, the matter part will have basically this, and then there will be a coupling between phi and the trace of the union for psi, which is basically this, the second.
Phi to the curvature in the Jordan frame is to produce the coupling semantic in the Einstein frame. That's what happens.
Sorry, I was...
When you do the conformal transformation in the Jordan frame,
yes.
The cost of removing the phi r,
yes.
The phi curvature coupling, is to produce the coupling the matter and the Einstein.
Exactly.
I think we.
That's what's happening.
I think
we should let him move on.
Okay.
It's important to get this clear.
Yeah, I think there's universal agreement at this point.
Okay. By the way, this transformation is the equivalent of what Alberto talked about yesterday, is the mixing. Of the between the gravity and the scale. Okay, so let me give you caveat number one, which is well known. And actually, if you think about it, it's very obvious. The true inertial mass of an object is, of course, not just the volume integral of the meta-dimensional, but actually, you should actually put in the pseudo energy momentum tensor, because that really tells you the full contribution from matter. From gravity and perhaps even from the scalar. And in general, clearly there's no reason to expect that this object is equal to that object, unless you know somehow your object in question, its mass is really not dominated by gravitational or scalar self interactions, which is most non-relativistic objects are of that nature. But if you look at a black hole, for example, clearly it has a non-zero inertial mass, but that mass comes entirely from basically non-trivial the self-interactions of the graviton. If you like, it's a gravitational binding energy. And we also know a black hole is a good vacuum solution of GR, meaning the matter diminution is just zero. And so for a black hole, the charge to mass ratio is not one, in fact, it's zero. If you like, this is some consequence of No-Hare theorem. A black hole cannot support a scalar charge. And therefore,
if you actually try to do this experiment that I said, let me drop a black hole and a regular star in some external field, they would actually fall at a rate that is order one different. Because the black hole would not be coupled to the external scalar force, whereas a regular star like the sun would. And therefore, if the coupling is very little strength, then effectively they see a G that is really order one different. And this is sometimes known as the not that effect. And more generally, if you don't have a black hole, perhaps a good guide to the charge to mass ratio in this context is basically more or less one for a non-relativistic object, but there's a correction just of the order of V over C squared, where V is like, let's say, something like the velocity dispersion of that object. That tells you basically the gravitational potential of that object. So this effect is really a relativistic effect, if you like. When you have something like a black hole, this ratio can really go to zero. When you have something that's not quite a black hole, for example, a neutron star, this would also be somewhat diminished. Q over M would not be exactly one. It would be diminished. But for most objects that we encounter, like a galaxy or a star, this would be very close to one, the charge to mass ratio. So that's caveat number one. Caveat number two, the scalar self interactions. I put up here again just to remind you of the theory that I'm considering. And here I'm really interested in basically effects that's coming from this term, which is the scalar self interactions. In the last slide, the effect is really coming from the graviton self interactions. The fact that for example, the mass of black hole is dominated by that. Whereas here I want to focus on the scalar self interactions. I want to repeat an argument basically was actually raised by John. Well, the naive reasoning would suggest, well, here the answer should be very simple, and that objects should just simply move on Jordan plane, where your matter is minimally coupled, like here. Your matter is minimally coupled to this overall Jordan plane metric. Just to give you more detail, if I combine this term, which is the scalar to matter coupling and the graviton to matter coupling, if I combine them and just relabel this whole thing some new metric, I call H tilde mu mu. This would be the Jordan frame metric. It appears your matter is just minimally coupled to that metric, and therefore your objects will just move on Jordan frame geometry. Period. Yeah? So that seems like a fairly reasonable reasoning. The issue is that if you run the previous argument that I talked about, when you look at the scalar charge of an object, when you try to assign a scalar charge to it, the scalar charge actually has sources not only from the method dimunium, it actually has sources coming from the self-interactions of the scalar itself, of course. Because, again, you have an object that is in the presence of some long wave mode phi. And the scalar charge of the object really should come from both this term and that term. That should be included. And when you have situations in which this gives you a sizable correction to the scalar charge, then you would have violation of the equivalence principle. And I'll give you explicit example in a minute. And let me just emphasize, these self-interactions are more or less mandatory. You have to have it. Basically, for solar system tests, this scalar, whatever it is, let's say it has a wave Compton waving of horizon scale, so it's really a long-range force, you must somehow screen it on small scales because we know GR works very well in solar system tests. And the way you would screen it is basically by invoking some kind of self-interaction. So these interactions are more or less mandatory. You really need it. And let me give you two examples. And the next slide is going to be a little bit busy. But given actually all the stuff that we have talked about in the conference, probably I can go through it very quickly. Let me just describe these two. One is called chameleon screening, and I actually underline basically the self-interaction term. In this case, it's just a potential. It's a potential interactions, and the way chameleon mechanism works, I think it's been discussed before, just very briefly, it works by basically giving the scalar field a mass that depends on the environment. Let's say the scalar field potential is this red line. In the effective potential, there's a contribution also from this term, which is scale with the density of your environment. If you're in a high density environment, the blue line would have a very steep slope, meaning your scalar field is at a small value here, high mass. Therefore, the scalar is green out. Whereas if you're low density environment, the scalar would have long range, small mass. That's the idea, originally discussed in the paper by Justin Curry and Amanda Wellman. There's a recent version, kind of fairly similar in many ways. What I'm going to say actually in the rest of the talk about chameleon would actually also apply to this other theory, it's called symmetron, also proposed by Justin Curry and Kurt Hinderbeckler recently. This actually turned out to be fairly similar in terms of the observational constraints. The other screening is Weinstein screening, which basically what was discussed by Alberto, I won't belabor the point, where the self-interaction is pure derivative in nature. And what is crucial in my talk is because these are pure derivative interactions, there's a shift symmetry, and that turns out to be important. This is the DGP self-interactions. They are generalizations for Galilean. Again, these self-interactions are going to be the important part of the story. Okay, so let's look at the chameleon case. So let me look, compare two objects here. Let's do an experiment. I have here an object that is fairly compact. It has a deep gravitational potential, and an object here that is not so compact has shallow gravitational potential. It turns out if you work out the math, the division between a screened object where the scalar is suppressed and an unscreened object where the scalar is unsuppressed is determined by basically the depth of the gravitational potential. You basically compare the depth of the gravitational potential of that object with the value of the scalar field basically external to that object. That comparison tells you whether you have a screen object, whether the scalar is massive and suppressed versus an unscreened object where the scalar, even inside that object, has a small mass and therefore unsuppressed. Now let's ask the question, well, what really is the scalar charge to this object? Well, one way to decide is, well, if I am somebody external to this object, I can measure basically the scalar profile of this object. It's going to go like something like Q over R, where R is the radius, the distance from this object. If you are this observer, what you would see is that the scalar charge of this object will be very small. And the reason is very simple, because the scalar charge, formally you should basically integrate everything, you know, inside this star or this object. But because inside this object, the scalar has a fairly large mass, and therefore most of the interior of this object will not even contribute to this external scalar profile. It's just become very Yukawa suppressed. The only part of this object that would source a scalar field that is seen by the outside observer is from basically what is sometimes called a thin shell of material, perhaps with the thickness of about quantum wavelength. Only, and therefore, while the mass of this object is contributed by the total volume integral of this object, M, the scalar charge is contributed by something that's much diminished. So the charge to mass ratio of a screen object really goes to zero, while the charge to mass ratio here, both charge and mass is contributed by the entire volume integral throughout the object, and therefore the charge mass ratio is of the order one. And this, I want to emphasize, this effect is really a non-relativistic effect. So the gravitational potential that we're talking about doesn't have to be large. It depends, of course, on the parameter of your theory. This is the phi, which is the standard phi. And because this object, the screen object, doesn't see a scalar force, just like a black hole doesn't see a scalar force, this object would fall at a rate that is order one different from the unscreened object. And i.e. a screen object really do not move on Jordan frame geodesics, contrary to naive expectations. Okay? If you feel unconvinced, which at first we were a little bit worried that whether this reasoning is quite right, you can actually check this explicitly by doing a detailed calculation, which I won't go through here. But it goes along the line of basically what you want to do is, in order to calculate the force on an object, you do basically a surface integral of momentum flux through that surface. And, but I won't go through that detail. And then you can see, you can actually explicitly check why this violation of the equilibrium principle actually occurs in Jordan frame. But I don't think I'll go through the details of that. Let me tell you the Weinstein case. In the case where the screening is by some derivative interactions, because of shift symmetry, the equation of motion takes this form. It takes the form of the conservation of some current. In the case of DGP, that current J mu is something that looks like that. The mu phi and then the interaction term. And the key here is because you have basically a Gauss law, the scalar charge is just conserved by the symmetry. And so there's no non-relativistic order one renormalization of the scalar charge, unlike in the chameleon case. However, I should say, even in the Weinstein case, the not bad effect is still there. However, probably it will be challenging to find ways to actually observe this for theories like DGP. Basically, because wherever that you might want to, you might find these objects, let's say a black hole, most likely that black hole would be sitting inside the Weinstein radius or something else, making it somewhat hard to see. Yes?
Are there black hole solutions in these theories?
Are there what?
Black hole solutions.
There are spherically symmetric solutions for, it's basically a spherical. Okay, lay on.
Yeah, but yes, it's like black hole with real horizons where gravity is important.
No.
In pure DGP, no.
No.
Are there explicit solutions? I don't think so.
Gregory solutions?
Yes. I think it's controversial. So.
Okay.
But he's saying it's superluminal, so then it's not going to be.
But here, I mean, here in the scale, if you forget about the full five-dimensional DGP story and you take this scalar tensor viewpoint,
yeah.
Well, here the black hole solution is that of GR, exactly because of the Noether theorem, no? A black hole cannot sustain a scalar profile, so the scalar is switched off in the presence of a black hole.
Okay, even in
that's part of the.
I see.
In the
story, no?
Yes.
Jordan Brand Sticky, the vacuum solution, there's a whole very large class of vacuum solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in GR, there's only one solution, it's called the Schwarzschild solution.
Yes.
So that makes a huge difference.
Yes, you have Birkhoff's theorem in one, but not the other.
Exactly.
Yes.
You don't have a Birkhoff theorem.
Yes. Yes. So I think I'll skip this part of the calculation. Let me give you a summary. And this summary I will actually transform to the Jordan frame. You know, that's the frame most of them we like to use when we compare with observations. And this is the summary for the chameleon. Yeah? The same more or less would be true for the symmetron screening. That the equation of motion, the inertial mass is on the left hand side, m here. The gravitational mass in some sense is m times this correction factor, where the factor depends on alpha. Remember, alpha is the strength of coupling between scalar and matter. And it will be order one. And epsilon here basically tells you whether the object is screened or not. If it's screened, the way I define it, epsilon is zero. If the object is unscreened, epsilon is one. If it's unscreened, you can see the inertial mass and the gravitational mass are just the same. And therefore, your object moves on Jordan frame geodesics, as one would expect naively. But for a screen object, a
again, a screen object is one where the gravitational potential of that object is actually fairly deep, deep compared to the external scalar field. In that case, that object would not move on Jordan tangent. The inertial mass and the gravitational mass, which is this one times this vector, are not equal. Now, the strength of this violation is generically order one if indeed you have gravitational strength coupling coupling. To give you an example, in f of r, for example, alpha is actually not exactly 1. It's this funny number 1 over root 6. In that case, if you plug in here, basically the unscreened to screen gravitational mass has a ratio of 4/3. Another way to say is the effective Newton's constant differ by exactly this factor. A comment that actually was at some point came up in main talk, I think. This special value of alpha, however, is not really protected by quantum corrections. It's not protected by, it's not protected against quantum correction. It's not a particularly symmetric point. There's no special symmetry that protects it. In general, if you start right with a bare coupling of this number, it's going to get you. So I think order one would be a fairly useful guide. And for these theories, for Hamiltonian theories, the important numbers are, again, alpha, the strength of the coupling, which tells you how strong a violation of equivalence principle you might have, and this field, which is basically the scalar field value, let's say at cosmic mean density. And this is a parameter in theory. This parameter controls what objects are unscreened and what objects are screened, because you want to compare this parameter of the theory, which is the field value, with the gravitational potential of that object. And here in the blue box, I give you kind of a very rough kind of estimate on how big this scalar field can be. Now, based on the fact that we know we want the solar system to be screened, if you look at the sun, for example, it has a gravitational potential of about 10 to minus 6. If you look at the Milky Way, it turns out it has a gravitational potential that's fairly similar. It's also 10 to minus 6. Therefore, if you just use this kind of comparison, if you want the solar system and therefore and the Milky Way to be screened, you want the scalar field value at cosmic mean density to be less than about 10 to minus 6. The caveats were mentioned actually in Wayne's talk also. One might consider possibility that perhaps the Milky Way is screened is because we are somewhat in a somewhat overdense region because of the local growth. So probably there's some slope in this number, 10 to minus 6. And therefore, these large scale structure tests that were mentioned in Wayne and Fabian's talk, they are interesting, give you kind of different kind of constraints. But most likely, I think even with uncertainties about the potential of the local growth and so on, probably the actual constraint is not going to be too different from this 10 to minus 6 number. So for this talk, I'll stick with that number. And so the observational situation is kind of like this. This is kind of a cartoon picture. If I draw the y-axis is the scalar matter coupling, and the x-axis is the scalar field value and intensity, the rule-out regions are basically in blue here. And basically, the reasoning is very simple. Anything that is any theory with a scalar field value that's larger than this is rule-out, because for those theories, neither the Milky Way nor the Sun is screened. However, that kind of argument would certainly be relaxed, of course, if you go to very small alpha, where the scalar field is just it's just irrelevant, yeah? Where the scalar field, even though it's there, it's basically not seen by anything. So the constraint probably looks something like this. What I want to talk about are ways that might actually push, if you like, push this constraint down here, probably maybe to as low as 10 to minus 8 in this value. And the idea is to do the kind of replicate Galileo's famous experiment of the Tower of Pisa. You drop two things and see if they fall at the same rates, except that you want to do this on a kind of macroscopic scales, and I divide the test into what I call bulk motion test, meaning I use a whole galaxy as a test object, and internal motion test where we use basically tracer objects inside within a galaxy, for example, hydrogen gas clouds or stars. And so let's talk about point number one, test number one, right? So what I said earlier about order one violation of the equivalence principle would imply, if the parameters of the theory is right, that small galaxies like a dwarf galaxy, let's say, it would actually fall faster than a large galaxy, large meaning Milky Way and larger. And this effectively would be some kind of velocity bias. It was a point raised by somebody in Panji's talk. You know, one of the assumptions that we like to make in large scale structure studies is that on sufficiently large scales, all galaxies are just test particles and they basically trace the same velocity field. If this effect were present, that would not be true. And so one has to kind of rework the predictions. However, I should say whether this effect is observable depends a lot on actually the quantum wavelength of the scalar field at cosmic mean density. I will have more to say about it in the next slide, so I postpone that for a second. But just beware, Yukawa suppression, I'll talk about that more. Another effect is kind of interesting, is that if you look at voids, which are actually in some sense the best places to look, because the voids are environments where you expect actually unscreening. There's no screening in voids. Whereas if you go to clusters, you expect screening. So in voids, you could actually expect to see basically small galaxies to stream out of voids faster than large galaxies. Again, because the small galaxies, being unscreened, they see a larger G. Whereas the large galaxies being screened, they see a smaller G. And this might be interesting from the point of view of a problem that has long been pointed out by Peebles, that their problems work with voids. And it looks like that problems seem not to be present for sufficiently luminous galaxies, but may be present for sufficiently faint galaxies. And this kind of effect would actually distinguish between small and large galaxies. So that might be interesting.
That's for large galaxies.
More commercial.
That's for large galaxies. So if you read the most recent version of this by Nusser and Peebles, they have a recent article in Nature about this. They're really focusing on the fainter guys, and they say, there still seems to be a problem for the faint galaxies, although I don't have a good sense of how strong we really is. But the Tinker and Hall paper is very nice. But it really is about the more luminous galaxies. Internal motion tests. If I look at, let's say, a small galaxy in the void or in the field. Again, the key here is to look at an object that is unscreened so that the scalar force is actually active. And you want that object, let's say a small galaxy, not to be sitting inside a cluster either, because the cluster has such a deep gravitational potential well. We call it blanket screening. We'll just blanket screen everything inside. Then the scalar would also be invisible. So you want to pick objects that have a shallow gravitational potential well, that are not in clusters, i.e. in the fields or in voids. If you look at such a galaxy, it's conceivable you will find the following situation, that the hydrogen gas, if you measure basic hydrogen rotation curves, you know, 21 centimeter rotation curves, you would deduce a different mass for that galaxy compared to if you actually look at the motion of stars, because hydrogen gas being diffused would remain unscreened inside that galaxy, whereas stars being compact, just like the sun is green, would be screened, and so they do not see the scalar force. And so you would deduce different dynamical masses, if you like.
there are some astrophysical effects that one has to worry about. I'm not going to talk about that much here. Point number four is the gravitational lensing mass should, in general, agree with the dynamical mass from stars, but disagree with hydrogen, the mass from hydrogen in small galaxies. Basically, because again, photons, they actually do not see the scalar force, because the scalar, remember, is coupled to the trace of Dmu, a photon, that trace is just zero. So if you have photons and a screen object like a star, neither of them see the scalar force. So they should actually have the same dynamical mass. Whereas a test object that is somewhat diffused, shallow gravitational potential well, that actually see the scalar force, would actually give you a different dynamical mass. I might have some more to say about this. Here I want to show you, just to show you some work that is being done actually by a student at Columbia, Catherine Stanulik and Jeffrey Mangalcom. They actually have been systematically taking data of void galaxies. These are all different void galaxies picked out from the Sloan survey. And for reasons of their own, which is completely unrelated to this, they have been picking both optical spectra and resolved optical spectra and H1 rotation curves of these galaxies. So it's a nice, kind of provides a nice place to actually test this kind of ideas. So I have, how much time do I have?
2 minutes,
okay.
In order one difference.
So it depends, so how much a difference do you expect for the different rotation curves for the hydrogen versus?
I mean, my guess is you're constraining the difference to be, 10% or something.
That's right. So the theoretical prediction for how different that could be depends on this number I call alpha.
Okay.
Yeah. So if alpha is, like in F of L is 1 over root 6, then the dynamical mass should have this ratio. Might be a little bit challenging from the data.
Yeah.
If alpha is order 1, then you can probably see it. It's there.
So, but wouldn't you expect simply the growth of large structure to be different? Because you start with these smooth fluctuations, which as soon as a halo realizes, it becomes screened, and then things change and feels different. So even velocities, a lot of things will change.
Yes.
Because without going to astrophysical objects, I would naively expect that the growth factor would not be. No, you could get all kind of much more robust effects.
Very nice. So that kind of goes along the line of this first fact I was trying to point out here.
Yeah.
And if you look at the last year's structure of galaxies, depending on whether that galaxy is on screen or not, the effective growth factor for those galaxies will be different. Which is the same thing as saying that the velocity will be different. But that's a caveat, which
is speaking just.
But that's a caveat, actually, to that point exactly, which is what I want to raise here. In F of R theories, at least the versions of F of R that's currently being considered, the quantum wavelength, even at min density, is actually fairly short. And the reason is fairly simple. Let me just go through that. The mass square of the scalar field is secondary to the potential, which, if you just make a naive guess, would be of the order 1 over 5 times the derivative of the potential. And remember, you are basically in a regime where basically this is the potential, this is B, this is phi. This is the part of the potential coming from the coupling to matter. You have basically balancing between this one and this one. And that balance tells you dB, dB phi would be on the order of h squared at min density. And therefore, by this reasoning, the mass of the scalar field at min density would be of the order of h squared over phi. If phi is indeed of the order of 10 to the minus 6, the quantum wavelength of the object is actually a fairly small fraction of the horizon. It's about a megaparsec. And that Yukawa suppression really makes it hard to see actually this kind of effects on large scales, on scale beyond
the quantum wavelength. Basically, the scalar force is basically impossible. It will be very Yukawa suppression. Yes?
The fingers of God may be modified.
Mm-hmm.
in small scale.
But actually, they are within a large scale.
But they are in there, that's great.
So, yeah. So never mind.
Okay, so that's why we think, at least for these theories, the better place to look is looking at not bound motions of galaxies, but internal motion within galaxies. Because the quantum wavelength is still larger than the size of the galaxy. And therefore, internal motion might be more promising from that perspective.
Well, I mean, yes. If you draw up the requirement that it satisfies solar system tests, then you can still compare small clusters with large clusters and see that the fingers of God, for example, or dynamical mass is different. That's what I showed yesterday. Yes. So,
but I would think you want to satisfy the solar system
test. So in effect, as far as I understand, you think it's just controlled by the potential, right?
The gravitational potential of the object.
That's, so you're saying if the potential at one point is below some threshold, then it's a screen.
It's more complicated than that, actually.
It is more complicated.
When you want to... so you want to tell us your interesting discussion?
Sorry, teacher.
No, it's okay. back to Niyash. So, if I have an isolated object and I want to decide whether it's green or not, a good guy would be the gravitational potential of the object. However, it's not true if you go to Fabian simulation and look, this point has gravitational potential of this, and therefore it's green or not green. That actually does not work exactly. So that's point number one. And point number two, this actually cares about the sign of the potential. So if you think about it, we already know there are 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations in the universe. Of basically potential fluctuation in the universe, which means, naively, you would think, basically, if phi is indeed 10 to the minus 6, then everything in the universe would be spring. But that's actually not true, because it actually cares about the sign, whether the density is over-dense or under-dense. If you go to actually under-dense regions, it's because of this effect. Well, then it really depends on the parameters. It really does depend on the parameters.
So what happens in galaxy clusters?
In galaxy clusters...
So the X-ray mass versus the dynamical mass. And the
very good. I think I'll cover that in the next slide. Yes. If I don't, please remind me. But I also want to make a point of this argument. It's not completely foolproof. This scaling, in particular this equality, that the second derivative is of the order 1.5i times the first derivative, that doesn't have to be true. It's easy to write down potential whether that's not true. In which case, it's conceivable you can write down theories where this phi is fairly small, but the quantum wavelength at cosmic link density is still fairly long. And that's kind of nice because, in some sense, when you modify gravity, you really want one. You want actually the scalar force to have an effect on horizon scale, not only on 1 megaparsec scale. And these theories should be possible to write down. It's kind of work in progress. I talked to Fabian the other day. You know, it would be nice to actually put these theories on computer as we see. This kind of interesting effects with a very, if a much longer quantum wavelength, it would be much easier to see these effects. In other words, what I'm suggesting here is perhaps, you know, in the spirit of exploring phenomenologically what are the possibilities of modified gravity, it would be good, useful to decouple basically the value of phi and the quantum wavelength. And in fact, I believe it's actually possible. You don't have to consider theories where they are actually tightly related in this fashion. Okay, and then we'll be discussing also with Kurt and Justine on this issue for the simulacrum. And we believe it's possible. Okay, random comment number two. This is related to Hugh's question. So let me just say again, I think I said this before, but maybe I didn't say it very clearly. In general, what is the statement? The lensing mass would be equal to the dynamical mass for a screen object. So for my purpose, let me take a screen object to be a cluster. Inside that cluster,
what happens? The photons would not see the scalar force. Again, photons is not sensitive to the scalar because the trace of photon is at zero. And if you look at basically screen objects inside, actually let me not take a cluster. Let me see. Let me step back. Let me take a galaxy. So I have some galaxies. Let's say this galaxy as a whole is unscreened.
Unscreened galaxies. Yeah. If you try to measure the mass of these galaxies, you can measure the mass by lensings, by photons. You can measure the mass by dynamical mass from stars. You can also measure the dynamical mass from diffuse hydrogen gas. What I'm saying here is these two guys are guaranteed to agree because neither the stars nor the photons see this fifth force. The photons, because it's just by the nature of photons, the star because it's free. Whereas the hydrogen gas is unscreened because it's diffuse. And so the dynamical mass of these would actually be different than that. And likewise, in a more general context, let's say away from galaxies, let me say I just have some large scale structure. Some large scale structure. And let's say now I have massive galaxies versus small galaxies. Now, I can also try to measure the mass of this large scale structure by three methods, by lensing, by looking at motion of these massive galaxies, and looking at the motion of these small guys, pressure distortion, and so on. Again, the idea here is, if this background large scale structure is unscreened, the small guy would see this a scalar force, whereas these two guys would still not see the scalar force. And therefore, this adds an interesting twist, if you like, to a test, a very nice test that suggested by Kenji, right? Where you measure basically more or less the lensing versus dynamical mass. In some fashion, of course, it's a statistical measurement. And the twist here is that basically you are guaranteed to find agreement between photons and the mass of galaxies. And but for small galaxies, perhaps you will find deviation from GR. Yeah.
Yes. Will black holes go away from the galaxies?
Ah, very nice. So if you have a galaxy that is unscreened, then the stars and the hydrogen gas, or dark matter particle for that matter, would actually fall at different rates around the galaxies. And what am I worried? Wouldn't that rip apart basically the... If the galaxies is falling in some large-scale structure,
yeah,
gravitational field, would that rip that apart? I mean, you can actually do a simple check. Basically, what's going on is, for basically a very light system, the gravitational force is so dominated by the self, basically, gravitational force of that system, that this kind of ripping apart the object doesn't really happen.
Oh, is it true, but if the galaxy falls on a cluster, I mean, the escape velocity from the galaxy is, I don't know, 100 kilometers a second, and it moves at a few hundred kilometers a second towards the cluster. So, is it true still that the gravitational force on the galaxy is stronger than the gravitational force on the cluster? I'm speaking when
yes.
The galaxy is still in the outskirts and the outskirts of the region.
Yes. I believe so. I mean, we can go through the numbers. But we did simple checks that it basically the self-binding force of that object is sufficient to keep everything together. But that's a very good question. I mean, at some level, that should happen, that ripping apart at some level is there.
So the velocity and power spectrum, peaks on large scales, right? Right, so scales larger than this constant wavelength, right?
The velocity.
Velocity, yes. Power spectrum.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So therefore, this effect sounds like it will be very hard to.
That's why. That's why I make this comment about this. Yeah.
that it would be very useful, at least in the spirit of exploring the possibilities. I mean, this would not be very nice theory in terms of quantum corrections and so on. But they would be, in the spirit of exploring possibilities, phenomenologically, you can find theories where the quantum wave is actually very large. Where, while still having interesting, some objects will be screened, some objects. Basically, in other words, decouple the quantum wavelength and the scalar field. And basically, what we want to do is basically play with potential. And I believe it's possible.
So basically, yeah. If we combine the LRT and the 21 centimeter inequalities, so we would be able to measure their velocity difference at k smaller than 0.1 and about 10% accuracy.
Yes. Yes.
So do you think any of these models would produce this larger than 10%?
Sure. I mean, if alpha, if the coupling is large enough, yes, you can. I should say, you know, that we already know there's velocity bias on small scales.
That's right.
So purely from dynamical friction,
yeah.
For example. So if you want to check for this particular effect, you want to do large scales.
Right, yeah. Now, the 10% it means k is less than 0.1.
Yes, yes.
0.1 it will make nothing.
Yes, yes.
But if you increase alpha, then you have to reduce, then the threshold for chameleon also increases, then you have to reduce the field level again, right?
The threshold for, yes,
yeah,
that's right. But the, you know, but you know, we are not talking about changing alpha by 10. Only from 1.6 to 1 already, this is a very different ratio of effective and response. So I think I should wrap up.
No,
I'm not sure I answered.
No more random comments.
That's it.
Yes. 10% error, I said.
This is the plan that I show at the beginning, and this is my summary.
Right. We are way over.